to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Bobby, I saved this podcast, Osinski.
Hi, Mike.
Bobby, welcome. And he really did, and I'll tell you why in a second. Next to him, we've got Scott. I have a new friend on Facebook.
Hi.
And across the table, we've got Brandon. I do a lot of swooshes, Burnside.
What's up, Mike?
And next to me on my left-hand side, we've got Rob Arbiter.
No goofy middle name.
Hello, Mike.
See how I mixed it up?
Yeah, that was nice. Yeah. You threw us for a loop.
I like when you look to your right and mention someone's on your left.
See? Behind-the-scenes magic.
That's right.
Stereo is everything.
But actually, Rob, the Iron Man of the
Iron Man. Okay, I'll take the goofy name.
This is show number 98. This is also the last show of the year, guys.
This is it. Merry Christmas, everybody.
So,
the last good one, anyway.
That's right. And today, we are honored to have a guest, a couple friends of Bobby Osinski. Eddie Schreier from Oasis Mastering is joining us, along with his friend, David Chepa. Guys, welcome to the Audio Nowcast.
Thank you.
Welcome, guys.
Great to get here. Thank you.
Pleasure.
And, you know, there's some podcasts where it seems like, you know, we do a pretty good job and it's fun, but there's other podcasts that I get to that I just can't wait to start. And this is actually one of them, because we're going to be talking about a lot of really cool things today. We're going to be talking about mastering with Eddie, and we're going to be talking about vinyl, or as Bobby O put it, vinyl in the 22nd century. Because David Chepa is just a guru on vinyl cutting and vinyl cutting machines, and Eddie has a background with vinyl and mastering, and obviously if you look at his credit list, which we'll put a link to, has mastered like every type of music known to mankind.
A wide genre, at least. Thank goodness.
And some really great, I mean, Queen to Stryper to Saga to, see, I know who Saga
wow.
is.
You've built up this podcast so much, I'm worried we're going to ruin it now. Yeah. Like, how can we possibly live up to
really
it?
We
went from Queen to Saga.
Excuse me, I have to go now.
Yeah, we're going to do a whole podcast about that list.
Really. Anyhow, so, hey, but before we get going, there's a couple things I want to take care of. And first of all, since this is our last podcast of the year, and it's going to be out around Christmas time, I'm going to do a really quick buyer's guide to beginning software for people out there. And the buyer's guide is get the latest special from Computer Music Magazine. Because we get a lot of people who come in, who write in and ask, you know, if you're starting off, what do you do for, you know, if you don't have any budget, if you don't have a lot of money, things like that. And quite frankly, you know, I don't think this is the best podcast for us to be answering those kind of questions because we don't use a lot of those tools. But I will say that Computer Music Magazine did an amazing job on their special issue on free plugins. And it covers all kinds of free plugins. It covers sequencers, synths. It's just a lot of really good quality material out there. And I just wanted to point that along because I've been getting, especially coming towards Christmas, I've been getting a lot of people asking, you know, what do you suggest for someone who does not have a lot of money? And so I just wanted to let you guys know about that. So pick it up at the newsstand, or you can probably order it online, but it's Computer Music.
For $100, and you've console and a Studer 24-track.
Well, that too.
Wouldn't the best gift for somebody who doesn't have a lot of money just be money?
Yes.
See, oh, well.
Thanks for keeping it real, Rob.
I'm just saying.
I try to do a favor. Anyway. All right, moving on. One other thing I want to get to is on our Facebook page, there was someone who answered a question, and I think now is a really good time for us to answer it. We were talking about DAWs and all the different types of DAWs, and there was, you know, Pro Tools versus Logic versus Cubase, things like that. And someone asked about if we thought Cubase or Logic sound better than Pro Tools. And then another person actually emailed me and asked me about how can you tell the differences between the different DAWs out there. And so really quick, since we're just surrounded by some really great sets of ears today, I wanted to put that out there about the differences between the DAWs. Number one, do you guys notice the difference between the DAWs? And number two, how do you quantify those differences? Let's start with you, Bobby.
I was a Nuendo user since version one, and eventually I moved to Pro Tools. Yes, I heard a difference. There's something that's a little warmer about Nuendo. I can't quantify it at all, except I know it's there. It's not enough for me to want to use it because most of the rest of the world uses Pro Tools, and it's just easier. But yeah, I could hear it. Before that, I was a Digital Performer user from version one on that one, and I could hear the difference immediately going from Digital Performer to Nuendo as well. So I would say that's the best sounding to me. But that being said, it's not, the difference is very small.
And you know, one question I have is, especially when you compare something to Pro Tools, especially the older version of Pro Tools, is, are we talking about the software? Are we talking about the hardware? Because, you know, Pro Tools.
That's what I was going to say. The differences in the hardware that you'd use with these machines is going to be way bigger than the difference in any playback algorithm in the software.
And make sure you got a clock.
Yeah, but that being said, when I've done it, I've used common hardware in that I would always come out of the digital out.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha.
I'm just saying that. Into different
And you
converters.
Definitely will. That is a better test, and you will hear the differences. I'm just saying for most people, general public, that difference in sound quality is going to be less noticeable than the difference in hardware. I mean, if you're using...
And by the time you compress your audio and put it on YouTube, it doesn't matter.
Well, that's true.
I mean, you know, when you figure out what the end product's going to be, I always say use the product that you like. Like the plugins, like the way it's laid out.
Right.
What device makes sense to you? Because at the end of the day, the way we're all sharing music is not a high-quality medium.
But coming back to converters, just the hardware for a second.
Yeah.
Sound on Sound had a wonderful article this month on they had a converter shootout. They had the brand new Pro Tools. I don't know what they call it, but right. the new Pro Tools.
The new 192s, yeah.
192s, the old 192s, a Prism, and I think the Apogee Symphony. And they had, you know, their UK Golden Ears listening, and, you know, they had double-blind tests and everything. And when it came, when they finally measured the differences, at least, you know, when they try to rate them, they found out that they all sounded pretty much the same. And they were cutting hairs, they were splitting hairs, right. And it finally came down to which ones they liked better, and nobody could agree. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can basically say that everybody uses the same guts anymore.
Yeah.
So the differences are really small.
As time's going on, absolutely. But D-Day is very, very important.
Yeah.
D-Days or A to D's?
A to D and D to A. I'm talking about both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So a lot of these systems can be improved with aftermarket.
Gotcha. Do you notice, Eddie, when you're getting material that you master, do you find the choice of DAW, does that make a difference to you? I mean, do you notice that?
It's too late for me at that point anyway. It's you know, set in stone. But what happens is, I think, like anything else, your interpretation of what you're hearing is the D-Day. Can't be overstated. D-Day is a very important, crucial step.
But isn't D-Day pretty much what they have at their house?
I'm sorry? No, I'm saying that the digital to analog, what you're absolutely hearing at your monitor is how you're interpreting what you're hearing through your system.
Right, but if someone's playing back a CD or something off their computer...
No, I thought we were talking about mixing.
Oh, okay,
and DAW systems. I thought you were talking about input. You know, the actual multi-track system of DAW recording, you're interpreting what you're hearing via the D-to-A, and there's so many changes. However, that being said, I think the bottom line is what Bobby mentioned earlier. At this point in time, in 2010, 2011, the differences have been marginalized to the point where it's pretty negligible. The earliest Cubase, I'm going back to early 2000s, Cubase sounded better than anything I'd heard.
Really?
Music mixes would come in and sounded more analog, more like analog, certainly than the Pro Tools by far.
And that's why Nuendo sounded good to me, Cubase.
Nuendo, Bobby knows, actually turned us on to Nuendo. Nuendo was our playback system for digital sources and sounded a little better. I actually did some shootouts where I played back the same file, if you will, loaded it into Nuendo, played the file back, mastered it into the system, played the exact same file back, same EQ from the Pro Tools session. The Nuendo sounded better, and not by a small bit, by a large margin. The I would say to qualify the difference in the sound, the Pro Tools audio sounded collapsed and slightly smothered.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah,
like yeah. clock issues. They, like
yeah, we know the collapse. I hear the thing is the moment you record reverb, because I love spatial.
There you go.
Being in design, so when you get these amazing, wonderful spatial recordings. And
absolutely.
Then they close down narrow, a little bit.
And they sound a little smothered.
And they, yeah, and they just, that
they
depth of field,
to be, yeah,
they
depth.
Just it just feels a little defocused.
Absolutely.
Image-wise and depth of field-wise. And compared to if I'm recording on super high-end recorders and I listen back to them, I put in Pro Tools and it just has a sound.
Absolutely correct. Yeah, I think it has more of a sound and slightly negative, however, the 192s.
Yeah,
far superior.
No, but let me ask you this: when you master, though, if you stay in the digital realm, come out of Pro, do you find that it sounds better? In other words, going through all your digital mastering gear and then coming out something else, rather than coming out analog slash.
Well, I'm getting typically .wav files though that are created off of a Pro Tools session, so I'm getting a stereo interleaved or mono left rights
right
onto a DVD disc or
yes.
on, from a hard drive. So I'm not playing back from Pro Tools.
Is there anything that you do to get rid of that
no,
sound?
It's too late.
Okay.
By the time it gets in, it's too late.
It's printed.
Sorry.
By the time you see that bone doctor, the arm is broken.
One other thing I wanted to add, a lot of these comparisons that we're talking about, like old 192s versus the new Avid IOs and Prisms and all these other things, they, you know, the quality level's gotten so good that to a lot of people, they're not going to hear much, if any, of a difference. But a lot of our listeners may not realize there's still a huge difference in different
price range.
Yeah, different price ranges. Like if you're going to compare, you know, the cheapest M-Box with some really expensive high-end converter, you are going to hear a huge difference. It's not that every single converter out there, because it's, you know, 2010 or 2011,
right.
every converter is awesome. It, once you get to a certain price range, it's really hard to hear the difference. But there is still a huge range. There are a lot of inexpensive hardware I.O. boxes,
yeah.
and they may have some nice features, but if you're getting a multi, you know, input and output interface for your computer for $100, don't think it's going to sound like a, you know, a $10,000 box. There is still a pretty big difference, and that is noticeable. That you don't have to have golden ears to hear that.
Well, so it sounds to me like at one time there was definitely some differences, but nowadays, be honest, like Scott says, it really kind of doesn't matter. You've got to find the tools that you're comfortable with, the ones that you like, and then go out there and make some music. And as Rob said, spend some money on some high quality converters, and I think that'll get you by far a better bang for the buck.
But you know what? There's no great converter that's going to fix a bad melody, and there's no terrible converter that's going to ruin a good melody. You know, the content of what you're recording is still so much more important. All of the technology has gotten so good that, you know.
But one's engineer, one's the composer.
Right.
And for the guy who's
well, but a lot,
worried
it's
about
the same guy a lot of times, though, these days. We're talking Project Studio. I'm talking that mindset. You don't – it's bad for someone who just wants to – who has maybe $1,000 total to spend for computer and everything else to think they're not going to be able to make a hit because they can.
But you know what I find is – and I don't disagree with that at all. But what the difference between even demos – there's a guy that's got a mic out there. You hear the room. And, I mean, you look at YouTube, and the guy goes, "Look, I'm miking my amp," and it sounds like a room. It's all tubby sounding. You go, "Yeah, but he's playing amazingly."
You mean the guy with 25 million views?
You know.
Okay.
But the thing is, though, is but it still sounds indie. It sounds cheap.
Yeah.
And I think that there's so much great technology out that allows you to get actually a very sophisticated tone. In addition, because you need both. You don't want to be distracted by it sounding like a garage band when you're doing great stuff. What you want to be able to do is take advantage of the technology that's actually incredibly affordable in addition to best represent your creative material.
Mm-hmm. Can't argue with that either.
Yeah, well.
And speaking of, you know, creative material.
What a segue. That was awesome. Actually, let's see where you're going with it first.
Forrest Robinson walked in.
That's a pretty good sound. Forrest, creative.
Nothing but creativity there. Forrest, it's good to see you, buddy.
It's good to see y'all. It's been, I hadn't seen y'all since the earth was cooling, I guess.
So Forrest is joining us on the last podcast of 2010. Have you met Bobby Osinski, by the way?
I have not.
We traded. We're actually having this is Bobby. He just turned blonde. Lost the accent. You know, sort
of the whole bit. So, oh, my goodness.
Well, you'll have to fill us in later on what you've been up to. I've seen your tweets. I've seen your emails, and you've been doing some stuff out there. So it'll be good to catch up with you.
I have a request. You might have spoken on it already, but these guys, you know, I walked in on this whole bit depth versus sample rate. I mean, to me, that sounds like a – have you elaborated on that at all?
No, what did you want to find out? Go ahead.
I just want to know your thoughts about, you know, bit depth, you know, versus sample rate, why – like, just, you know, why perhaps those who are, you know, all of us creators, you know, who cannot maybe tell the difference, know the difference, even more importantly, like, why even bother? Like, why is that important?
Some things are subtle and some things aren't.
Sure. Can you elaborate on the subtlety or anything?
Well, I would say if you have the choice and you can record a 24-bit,
absolutely,
no matter what sample rate you use, it's always better. You'll have better dynamic range and a cleaner recorded, project, without a doubt.
I mean, when I went to a 24-bit, it kind of blew my mind. It wasn't even subtle, because all of a sudden, especially for low end, I started low end was punchier. It just you A-B'd it, and I didn't think it was a very. It's not like, well, it's pretty subtle, and it depends on how you play
it's
it.
Pretty
back.
Obvious.
It's pretty obvious.
It's pretty obvious, especially if you just record something at a low level or just listen to the end of a reverb tail or just something that's really down in the dynamic range. Mm-hmm. The difference, I mean, I remember the first NAMM show when everybody was crowing about 24-bit. It was noticeable enough with a low-level signal that you could display it at a NAMM show. You know, like people could actually hear the difference in a booth at the NAMM show, which means it's pretty obvious.
It's almost like 16-bit was tube TV. 24-bit is flat screen TV, and then the super, and then 96 is that really nice LED TV, mm-hmm, where all of a sudden everything's just a little sharper, a little more colorful, and that's, I mean, would you agree with
absolutely
that?
Absolutely. In a nutshell, you know, the foundation can't be too good. So the better you've started, right, and by that I mean the bit depth, the better the recording actually is, the better survival rate you have down the chain. Or down the path, if you will, to the wonderful MP3. Dare I say anything?
Speaking of sample rate.
I knew we were speaking of something.
Yeah. I did a series of tests a couple years ago where we had multiple rigs set up and we recorded at 44.1, 48K, 96, and 192 and played them all back. And the results were mind-boggling, actually, yeah, because it wasn't exactly what I expected. 192 sounded so real. It was amazing.
Yeah.
It really sounded terrific. 96K didn't sound nearly as good afterwards. It was funny because, to me, prior to that, listening 48K to 96K, you could hear a substantial difference. But it was less than what I could hear from 96K to 192.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. That sounds fun, same thing.
Yeah. The only problem at that point was it was, you know, physically impossible to do a multi-track recording unless you spent a whole lot of bucks because everything halves and you know, your storage goes up and everything, that it really wasn't practical. It's starting to get that way. I can't wait to hear what it's going to be like when we go to the next level up. It's 384. Right. Yeah.
Then we're always melting down.
Seriously, we're going to 384? I mean, I found that
melting.
Why?
But we have to.
I found that the plugins. I mean, I found that 48 and 96 is incredibly usable. The moment I got to 192, some of the plugins weren't working.
Yeah, well, that's the
system
problem.
Gets a little unstable.
Sure.
How am I going to play it back? And what I found was interesting is because I do a lot of location recording, is I did a bunch of tests where I recorded something at 48 straight, and then another thing at 96 converted down to 48. And the 96 converted to 48 sounded way better. than the 48 straight. And I don't know if they're doing the math.
Well, again, 48 to 96 is a half conversion. It's the same as 88.2 down to 44.
But you would think, theoretically, without having to go through a conversion, it would sound maybe better. But I found that, I don't know if 48 straight.
But I think you started with the better building blocks in 96.
Could be.
So to half it, you're not losing bits. Jim Lavery has great, I've had great discussions with Jim Lavery and Lavery Labs about this. And 192, as terrific as it sounds, does have a little bit of processing problem with actually recovering some information. There are bits that are lost, but that being said, it's ultimately can be the best sample rate.
All I can say is I heard it, everybody else that heard it kind of agreed. And, yeah. And we listened to, like, you know, pure acoustic sounds, acoustic guitar, acoustic piano, vocal, you know, people with keys. Yeah. The keys are the big deal. Yeah. Everybody does. But you could hear the difference. It was almost like it was real. You close your eyes and it's like, is it live or is it Memorex? Mm-hmm. Didn't get that.
Was it composite music or was it just solo instruments?
No, just solo instruments.
Okay, now here's a problem. And when you combine various instruments, and you're talking about a rock and roll band, and or, whatever genre music, you do a classical performance where there's no mono. It's 100% stereo, classical performance. Nothing's panned and mixed, if you will. You follow? I think you'll find 192 will be a little bit of a Swiss cheese scenario. And 96 will survive possibly better. I'd almost bet anything on that.
Why? Do you know that?
I've only heard 192 in comped music, you follow? You know, it's total mixes. Yeah. Huge difference. When you're combining frequencies, you know, various instruments, overtones, harmonics, blah, 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 the low-level echoes and such, that's when some of the digital anomalies start really rearing their head. Sometimes in a negative way, sometimes in positive. For the most part, I find negative.
I would think that would sound like it's a filter problem to me. Like
very much could be. I don't know if it's a process of the dither. I don't know why this happens. But Dan Lavery and I have had the discussion, and I've had some projects come in at 192 that I actually take to 96 that sounded better to me than they did at 192, which is the same scenario you just told me about 96 dropping it back to 48 and something got better.
Do you think that's the HD video makeup effect where, like, you know, early HD video, the makeup artists, the same makeup that they used to do in standard def just wouldn't cut the mustard because you see more and you
think it's the
clarity.
I can't imagine the bit depth and how long that word is at 192 for a bing, a snare drum, whack, which isn't necessarily sonically a big issue. However, violins, huge overtones, pianos, huge. AM radio, pianos sound out of tune. Simply because 5,500 cycle brick wall, you don't hear the overtones and harmonics on a piano. Everything in AM radio, I should say related to in the instrument, sounds out of tune to me, out of key.
Right.
But FM sounds better to me because of the bandwidth.
It's probably something to do with the fact that, you know, any circuit sounds and works better when it's not, you know, working at the very edge of its tolerances.
Well, that's complexity.
And 192
it's complexity.
192, the filters are probably right at the edge of what they can do, and it's just starting to grow.
When I was doing Kill Bill, we did 48, 96, and 192. Right. And I AB'd 192, and I'm like, I can't tell a difference. Because we were doing so many weird sound effects and breaking things and all that, that the overtones and all these complex waveforms, It was like analog. What you heard through speakers and when you A-B'd it back and forth was exactly the same.
Is this human dialogue? This is dialogue now.
No, this is
dialogue, music, dubbed down.
Think of it as sound effects. I had like 36 mics going and people doing martial arts with everything from breaking things to really subtle things.
Sure.
And when you went back and forth, 48, I can hear Pro Tools. I hear that sound.
Right.
192, I heard when you A-B between the mics and playback, I couldn't hear a difference at all. 96, I could hear a difference, but it wasn't a bad difference. It was like just different. I went, I can hear that.
Same way, exactly the same.
But what I found with field recording, and I don't know if it's math, I'll go out and we said, well, we didn't want to use, because film is at 48, why go to 96?
I didn't know this. Film's at 40.
So the thing is, why even bother? Why use all that real estate on the drives? And then we started A-B-ing, and it wasn't a subtle difference. Going and converting it down, because when we edit in 48, not 96. But capturing it 96 and converting it down, I was always wondering, because I always heard, like, when you
the
had
numbers
DAT,
are right.
When you DAT machines, you go, well, 40, you're never going to get all of
right.
the numbers, because
right.
you can't do it. So I always wondered if you went to higher bit rates or higher sampling rates, when it converts it down, it uses all the numbers because it.
Interesting.
I don't know if it's a mathematical thing.
Huh. Well, you know what? I think actually it's partly a mathematical thing, but it's because the sample rate conversion process can take a lot more time
yeah.
than the step down in the actual A to D process can.
Yeah.
And I think the math is probably more accurate. I think there's a lot that goes wrong in the math. You know, we did a lot of listening tests, including, you know, internally clocking converters and externally clocking them and things like that. And it all comes down, usually the differences you're hearing are a lot of times it's due to jitter and errors and things like
right.
that. And anything you can do to minimize that improves the sound quality. If you think about it, a software process that's reducing sample rate can take as long as it needs to.
That's right. True.
And so you don't get all those errors, but something trying to do it in real time is more prone to errors.
We found like 96 to 192 is the difference between listening to different speakers.
Huh.
Actually, there's more of a difference in different speakers than there is between 96 and 192.
Hmm. Wow.
I mean, it's just, you know.
So, Forrest, you got that?
That answer your question well?
As a drummer, 24-bit rocks.
24-bit. Take your pick between 48 and 96. 96 preferable.
But that being said,
it's more as a writer, though. That's the whole thing.
Kick and snares and bits and cymbals and separate.
But that being said, after saying that I fell in love at 192, and it sounds terrific, I insist on recording at 4824
really?
These days. And the reason why is it's less of a pain in the ass.
Absolutely.
It works great. There's never a problem. And the difference between that and 96K is not that difference for the type of music that I do. People won't know the difference. And there's less of a hassle factor involved.
It always comes down to two words these days. Good enough.
It's good enough.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, most of what we end up doing is 4824.
Well,
because
it's
good enough for most things.
85% of our work is 48K.
Yeah. And in post-production, all the TV commercials that I mix, it's still 16-bit because that's what the guys are.
And all the movies we mix are 48.
Yeah,
right. 24.
So
aim high and end up low.
That's
the
story is it's all about your building blocks.
Absolutely.
You have to just start with
the foundation. And you know, God forbid we go back to the top of how the drums are tuned, who's playing them.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean,
and 24-bit.
How much
only
duct tape?
Yeah, exactly.
24-bit is only half again as much storage as 16-bit.
Sure.
So it's nothing.
Well,
I mean, hard drives are cheap.
Do we want to get into dither at all?
Compared to 24-16,
you won't hear me complain.
What I found is when you do a lot of processing with plugins, the 24-bit it's a different game. Because 16-bit, you do have different issues.
Well, and if you work at 24-bit and it's time to go to 16, the best thing you can possibly do is take it to Eddie.
because for the plug, Oasis Mastering will be happy to do this.
Well, because the truth is, a lot of people just go from 24-bit to 16-bit by sawing off 8 of the bits, and that is not good. And that's where, you know, dither comes into play, and there are a lot of different kinds, and leave it to a professional if you can.
Just for fun, let's do a mix at 24, do a mix at 16, listen.
Yeah.
The 16 will sound like it's blanketed, I guarantee you.
No.
And you'll hear distortion that you're like, huh? I didn't put that in. Not a happy distortion.
So, Eddie, really quick. So when they listen to compare the two, they want to listen for the clarity and what happens on the low end and as well as what's happening on the high end. I mean, how should they listen? That's basically what I'm asking. How should they listen to compare the mixes?
I think extension, you know, highs and lows, how extended the lows are, how extended the highs are, and the musicality of actually, you know, the instruments per se. And that'll be the 24-bit difference. It'll every time.
You know, actually, a good question. This is perfect because one of the problems that beginning mixers always have is, what should I give to mastering? What sounds good? What doesn't sound good? Can you tell everybody what's the biggest problem you get with some of the mixes that come in?
Probably number one would be over-processing. And it's not necessarily over-processing at the multi-channel stage. It's over-processing at the two bus. So once an engineer has created a mix, he's competing with possibly other engineers. He wants to make his mix sound louder. That's the battle. The loudest mix, unfortunately, very often can win. So at that stage, the mixer, unfortunately, is vulnerable and having to do some two-bus work, which is what absolutely makes the music, the actual mix, suffer tremendously. So too much L3, L2, too much two-bus compression, too much, two-bus equalization, all you're doing is adding distortion. A good mastering engineer can do it more often, better, and more succinctly than the engineer can.
Are there any plugins that you like, let's say within the Pro Tools medium, that you've been impressed with that have mastering capabilities?
Pro Tools, actually, you know, I when I think of Pro Tools, I think of Waves automatically. I happen to be a very big fan of UAD, for example.
Right.
Very big fan of the Wave Lab proprietary plugins, mm-hmm. which are Steinberg. Hyatt Steinberg.
Yeah, they're surprisingly good.
They're terrific, I think. I'm not really, you know, what's native in Pro Tools world? Is there anything? It's always aftermarket, third party, correct?
Yeah, but, third party wise, you know, whether it's Isotope, some of those players, is there any things that you say, you know what? If you want to, you know, what do you,
well,
things that, yeah.
Yeah, to better answer the question, at the mastering stage is a little different than the recording stage, so it's hard for me. I cannot judge what would properly be used at an actual tracking stage versus a mastering stage. It's very different.
What about mastering?
Well, UAD,
yeah.
as I mentioned, great stereo plugins.
What about T-Racks?
No. Oh. Again, I haven't played with it. But again, you're mentioning things that are very, very, very good for tracking and mixing. The stereo... the stereo end of the spectrum, when we're mastering in stereo, it's a different set of ears and a different application of very specific plugins.
Have you played with it? Was it the BTX Digital from Germany? The ones that take the sounds? I think what they do is they split into an MS, so then you could control the mids at one, and then you can play with the stereo and combine it back.
Again, you know, mixers, that's a dangerous zone to go into, because generally the mixers at a certain level that we have at Oasis have created what they want with respect to MS, certainly. You're talking about spreading stereo and or caving it in.
Mm-hmm.
That can be – I hear a lot of – unfortunately, the digital world has brought about a type of distortion that I hear
mm-hmm.
that is not real pleasant. And devices like that can exaggerate those problems.
You know, you get some of the really high-end mixers bringing stuff in, and usually there's not a lot of problems with what they bring in because correct. They've already consulted with you on you know what the room sounds like and everything. But I know now there's more and more indie projects coming in, and I think it's those that are more interesting from the standpoint of what sounds bad
what
and what
doing.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Sure. Well, again, they've sometimes asked and or we've talked to them initially, this particular band or the engineer, and they'll send us a mix. We'll listen to a mix before they finish the project via FTP site.
I'm always curious because as a sound effects person, we don't have mastering. I mean, it's our worlds don't actually even meet.
Right.
Because it's like, oh, we'll go out and record a bunch of sound effects and then we need to master them, but there's no other set of people that do that.
Correct.
So I was curious what you... like, you know, that does compression that isn't...
good sounding compressors.
Exactly.
We use multiple compressors.
Before we get to that,
I'm sorry.
We're going to take a break. Actually, Rob, were you going to say something?
Yeah, there are two quick things I wanted to wrap up. We have actually done a lot of experiments with T-Rex. You mentioned,
right.
or somebody mentioned T-Rex earlier. And you know what? I know the guys who do it and everything, and they're awesome guys, but... It doesn't sound great. And the older T-Rex in some ways sounds better than the newer.
It's a very colorful sound. I mean,
it's purely for mastering. It's designed for mastering.
Yeah.
They
really?
They give you.
I have the mastering suite. That's all I've ever had.
You know what, though? If you actually compare it to good representations of the plugins it's emulating,
right.
I'm sorry, but it actually doesn't hold up that well. Huh. The other thing I was going to say that's a tip, if you're mixing stuff that you know there's a chance you're going to get mastered, but you're trying to win the mix wars, what we always will do, if we have to make something loud to win the mix war, we'll do it loud, but we will always run a master that
with
doesn't
without.
Have that compression,
absolutely
the two bus.
Correct.
So if you think there's a chance, even if you don't think there's a chance, if you're using some kind of heavy compression or EQ or something where you're trying to make the stuff sound like it's already in an iPod or already on the radio, run a mix without that stuff. That's what you should give to a mastering guy.
Right.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, we're going to finish what Scott asked. We're going to Eddie about compression and things like that. Because I'd like to know. I'd like to know about.
We're going to get him to name names.
Yes.
Multiband compression, things like that. And then we're going to talk.
My UAD faves.
Then we're going to talk with David. David, you still with us?
I'm here. I'm fascinated. One of the things I noticed that the skill level that you're dealing with, I mean, all these tools are wonderful, but it means nothing if you have no skill.
That's true.
You have art, science, and technology.
That's true.
And skill.
That's a good point.
And without the skill, you got nothing.
You know what? And on that note, I got nothing. On that note, we'll take a break, and we'll see you on the other side.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were picking Eddie's brain on everything.
This brain pus all over the table at this point.
I've lost my voice.
On everything. And so I wanted to take a break, but I want to pick it up talking about compression and things like that. But before we even get into that, Eddie, why don't you just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into mastering and some of the projects you've worked on? Because we did a little brief thing at the beginning, but you know, it's really impressive when you read your bio. And how did you get into mastering and what was your journey to take you there?
I'll try and do the abbreviated version because it's been a little over 30 years here, maybe pushing 40. I was actually a guitar player for about 15 some years and playing in local bands. And I decided it'd be a fun way to make a living being a recording engineer. I'll skip to the next step. I went to recording school, and I was very fortunate to be hired out of this recording school as an apprentice mastering engineer at MCA. I was working at MCA Universal in music editorial and syncing up black and white dupes. But I wanted to be behind the console. That was my big dream. Anyway, I got hired as a mastering engineer, and I didn't know what the hell it even meant. So basically, I took the job not knowing what mastering really was. And a gentleman named Larry Bowden was training me. Brian Inglesby hired me at Universal at the time. This was in the mid to late 70s. And so there I stayed. I loved mastering that much. Learned to cut lacquer. That was the process. Shortly thereafter, went to MCA Whitney. Moved to Capitol Records from one of the most fun times, certainly in my career, was Capitol Records. 82 to 89, I was mastering there. But it was the first time I really had a chance as a mastering engineer. At that point, maybe I had been mastering for 4 or 5 years, but I could walk down the halls and go to those wonderful studios and try and mix and track. So I got to work backwards, if you will, you know, from the mastering stage, working backwards and learning how the mixing process involved, what was involved in the mix and tracking process, and why I had such wonderful sounding mixes at times that were easy to master, and why I had such difficult times mastering different mixes at times. I think in a nutshell, what I learned mixing and tracking was to properly mic and least amount of EQ, properly miking and tracking an instrument, and the intonation of the instrument certainly in the player far more advantageous than twisting a knob. The cleaner the sound, even in the analog days, easier these projects were to go to vinyl. What else? As far as projects, I'm giggling because it's a blur. If I were to start early on, I think a fun little thing. I think one of the first, earliest record, Elton John, Blue Moves, was a double album when I was at MCA. I think I mastered, that was one of the earliest ones, Lynyrd Skynyrd, One More From the Road. That was another double album that was great. Zooming off into Capitol times, that would have been at Capitol Records, it's a blur. Striper, we mentioned.
No way! When
I walked in, back to, Under Command or something.
Yeah, we went from Poison. What was I doing? A lot of Babyface and L.A. Reid at the time. Yeah. Zooming through to Future Disc in the early 90s was everything from
Tracy Chapman to what were the big boys?
Porno for Pyros.
Porno for Pyros. Oh, yeah, with Jane's Addiction. Jane's Addiction. Yeah, I did Ritual Day of Bitch, one of my favorite albums of all time. Zooming back currently to Oasis would be Christina debut, Christina Aguilera, that is. Tune in name, Perfect Circle. I'm trying to run through my walls. Akon, Kanye West. I'm trying to run, look at my walls thinking.
Offspring.
Offspring. Yeah, actually.
B2K.
Eight or nine. Yeah, I think that was Gene. I did an early one. Yeah, going back. It's a lot of records.
Anyway, don't forget Wasp.
Wasp, yeah. Black and Wasp, another
Blackie
one.
Blackie Lawless.
I had a very wide genre.
I have a question for you. When you master something and you give it back to the producers and the band to listen to, and they're like, hey, I listened to it on my laptop and it sounds like, here's some of my notes. Because in other words, they're going to hear on something that's obviously not what you're listening on. And they believe
it's
in
always
their
notes. Been a situational problem. In the vinyl days, right, when I was cutting lacquer, in the Capitol days would be a reference disc. The client would take it home, and depending on if he had a grade O playback cartridge, they used to spit like hell on the top end of me. A lot of sibilance problems. So if a disc was a little bit on the bright side, a particular phono playback may not survive as well as an Ortofon, for example, playback system. Zooming ahead now to the CD world, you're absolutely right. People are listening to laptops, listening to any number of third-party speaker systems, you know, remote systems with little subs and such for their computers, or they're listening to the big system at home. Their big main systems could be, any number of Marantz, Pioneer, what have you. All these situations apply themselves as the listener interprets, and for the most part, right is right. And if we have a common ground, usually in mastering, that suffices. So MP3s have become a little bit of an issue with me because that's as a vinyl guy, you know, doing the amount of mastering I've done over this many years, I still tend to unconsciously and subconsciously, I'm always sort of hearing vinyl. And by that, I mean, highs, mids, and lows, and balance was very important to cut a good disc. Same thing pretty much applies to CDs without a doubt. But now the MP3, I find, mixes that are, an earlier question, but certain mixes that we get that are a problem, over-processing, if they're distorted, there's very often we have to send them back to the engineer and say, please back off whatever processing you're doing, give me a cleaner point source. That being said, when it makes the MP3, distortion starts really rearing its head. I find low frequency thins, upper mids get hard, and certain mixes that may be a little strong in these areas as an MP3 will not survive sonically as well as a good sounding mix, being, I would say, smoother, a little rounder, and certainly less EQ.
Well, it sounds like your ears have to change along with the time because consumers' ears are changing along with the time.
Well, they have, exactly. So when I say to you now, I've tended to, over the years, vinyl is soft. Dynamic range is reduced. Separation is reduced. There were certain limitations with certainly how bright you wanted to cut, you wanted to master going to vinyl, because distortion, physical contact medium,
right,
would actually increase by quite a margin. CDs, fortunately or unfortunately, are limitless. So basically, the low end can pound any way you want it to hit, and the high end can hit any way you want it to hit. It's still going to be distorted, but not necessarily the same screeching sibilance problems you had and or skipping you would have on a vinyl. A CD can't skip based on the physical geometry of a groove being crazy. That always following the groove geometry always followed the sonic quality of the mix, period. CDs don't care. It's a coated pit. We do listen for that now. I think currently I try to master actually a little darker.
I got
you. Not necessarily dark dull, but not allowing high end to be quite as peaky. You know, you want the high end being smoother, not too pointed, and just as I try to grind myself as most analog as I can make it sound. If I just think analog, then I tend to find myself mastering, I think, a little sonically, a little better in terms, especially ending up with the MP3.
Well, let's talk a little bit about really quick, since we have David here. Actually, did you want to ask one more question?
I did. I was going to say that essentially I do a lot of work also in video games. And what we constantly, when we're doing our mixes, we constantly the linear mixes, we're constantly taking into effect what they're being played back on. Because some people go, because sometimes we'll do home theater and it sounds great, and they go, yeah, but everybody's playing it through their little flat screen TVs, and we want to get the most out of that playback medium. And when you master music, do you say, hey, look, I know it'll sound great on B&Ws or you know, the different high end.
Correct.
But no one's going to listen that way. They're going to listen this way. So I need to kind of EQ and compress it so it sounds good on this.
I think the best answer to that question, I think, is apparent level is what you're after. Apparent level is achieved with compression. So smaller speakers, if you get the apparent level right, and I mean loud, with properly compressed and EQ'd, apparent level is the game.
Yeah.
Smaller speakers will tend to sound more bold and big.
Right.
With apparent level is the key. If something's thin and small and you haven't got this, you know, what I would say within the window, you know, within a window, sonically speaking, apparent level, you may have trouble with all these different systems. Right is right, and it's as far as you can go. You can't necessarily EQ for certain specific mediums because you never know what they may be, because MP3s have four different res formats now, AC4, three to four. MP3, so the resolution's huge. A 120 or a 320 MP3 is a huge difference.
Sure.
But, again, I think right is right. Balance is the key. And balance and apparent level.
Well, let's change topics for just a little bit, and because I really want to talk about this. And let's talk about vinyl. Let's talk about vinyl nowadays, because there seems to be...
Is there nowadays in vinyl?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. You can't imagine.
Absolutely. There seems to be a kind of a little resurgence going on. I actually heard a friend of mine who mixed a project, and they had a couple of their songs mastered to vinyl, doing like a one-off. They did a vinyl mastered, and then they played it back one time and digitized that, and they used that as their new master, their new reference master. And it was pretty cool. It really fit the song, but it just seems to me that there's this kind of resurgence in vinyl mastering. But the only problem I see is Techniques stopped making their turntables, I read online. They're one of the companies that have just...
Yeah, unfortunately, just recently.
So it's kind of crazy. It's like, you know, people are really getting into tires, and all of a sudden they're stopping making the car, you know? And so tell us, you know, what is it about the process? Tell us, walk us through the process of vinyl.
I'm going to let David answer that question, but I want to be very succinct on one situation, just so the listeners are clear. When you're mentioning that this client, you know... put his mix to vinyl. I'm pretty sure he didn't go through the lacquer through the three-step process to make vinyl. I just want to be very specific. What he did was he went to a lacquer mastering house, and he had a reference disc cut. Now, that's the first generation lacquer that he had a 12-inch ref cut, and he did one playback. Now, that is the first step in the process of making a vinyl record. So I just want the listeners to understand there's a three-step process involved to make vinyl, and he didn't do that.
What are the three steps?
Well, the three steps are...
I want Ed to do this, because Ed actually, you know, you cut more vinyl than anyone I've ever met.
The three steps. Well, quickly, 14-inch lacquer is used, and the A side is cut on one of the 14-inch lacquers. The B side is cut on the other. You now have a master lacquer. All the grooves, they're positive image. You know, the grooves are a V-shape, right? We understand that. That is those two plates, I don't want to call them plates yet. Those two lacquer masters are then given to a plant. And these lacquers are dipped into a solution. They're sprayed with silver nitrate, dipped into a solution that is, David knows
it's
better
nickel.
About this.
It's nickel. It's electroforming like you'd plate the bumper on a car.
Exactly. Gotcha. So there's a slight voltage applied to the actual, the lacquer has an aluminum substrate. There's a slight voltage attached to the, that's applied to the lacquer, which is has been sprayed by silver nitrate. In this chemical fluid, bags of nickel, like the size of 3/4-inch rocks or whatever, last time I saw it, this nickel's dissolving into this fluid and adheres itself to the silver nitrate spray that was on this lacquer. They then remove it after a certain period of time, once they deem the entire plate is covered. They remove the lacquer and literally peel away a metal image of that first lacquer that was cut. The metal image is the first step negative.
Right.
The grooves are sticking out now like mountain.
Right.
Same process is done. Spray it, dip it. Now they pull away the mother, which is now back to a positive. The mother is a metal image of the first lacquer that was cut and can be played just in any traditional turntable except that it's a big 14-inch plate. That is sometimes listened to for any impurities, whatever. The mother then is sprayed and dipped. The third step negative matrix is now made from the mother. Now we pull away another plate, same process. Now the grooves are sticking out like the mountains, and the plates A and B side are mounted in a press. And
Stampers,
so. The stampers, the third step negative matrix is now called the stamper. That is mounted in a press, A side, B side, hockey puck size of plastic is injected into the center, right? Plates come down. I don't remember the pressure.
Like 10 tons.
10 tons, something crazy. So now the grooves are sticking down. And this is why I'm saying this. Your gentleman that mixed this process bother doing this. This is like few hundred bucks to go through all this. And then the plastic oozes up and around the grooves, and we have spit out. Now, voila, back to a positive shaped groove, right? And that is the vinyl record. And then the flash is trimmed. The flash is the plastic that oozes around the 12-inch edges, right?
Right.
I remember seeing the process, the disc slides out of the press, and there's a knife, fixed knife, and the 12-inch disc just turns totally archaic and just cuts the trim off, the flash. And then it's someone would grab that disc and put it in a sleeve and then put it in a 12-inch cardboard.
That's the whole process.
Without the UZ. Just edit all my UZ out and we'll be happy.
Do you have a home kit for this that you can do?
Thank God, no. But anyway, he knows.
Actually, you can go online to Rainbow Records. Has a, I guess it's a YouTube video.
Right.
But it shows the whole process and it shows from cutting and everything.
So, David, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and what your expertise is with the whole vinyl?
Just to know the market, I was talking to about a month ago the owners of Guitar Center, and they tell me they sell more turntables than they do guitars.
Wow.
Wow.
Interesting. And they have rooms, 50 turntables in a room, and they'll help you get the stylus and the cartridge for older machines. Same with Radio Shack. They have 19 online turntables you can buy now.
Wow.
So they're available. And, of course, you see Costco selling vinyl and in Walmart, you know there's something's going on.
Indeed, right. Yeah.
I started at a time when the vinyl was the master of the day. You know, since I've cut 160,000 sites since then, according to the reports that we have. But, I'm a machine. I literally do 600 sites a month sometimes. And the only thing that I can tell you is that the most important thing for vinyl today is that you give us mastered masters. Because when Neumann developed the lathes, they intended that you have a master that's ready to go. All the elements are balanced.
Right.
So whatever art, science, and technology and skill, it's already there. I cut. And if it isn't right, it's not going to sound right. And Ed basically gave you the background for all of it. The better prepared it is, the better the master's going to be, the better the vinyl's going to be. It's really a matter of preparation. It's not very complicated.
So when you say you cut, you actually monitor and you're actually watching the grooves get cut in?
Sure.
Where do you work again? Where are you?
Okay. I own Better Quality Sound.
Okay.
I also own Universal Cutting Center. But Ed, he's being a cutter all the years that I've known him. We talked about collaborating for years. And he's had the facility for it, and just because of practical reasons, we couldn't do it. I mean, we were cutting around the clock. I couldn't, and still it's hard. But over at his facility now, at Oasis, we're building two rooms. We have one complete, but we're doing something that's never been done before. We're using, there's no more electronic racks. We now constructed the cutting cube, where you have the Neumann turntable, or the Neumann table, and we're using Ortofon electronics, but everything's integrated and welded into a huge frame. And so there's no ground loops. Everything is like so integrated now. There's no cables, no wires. It's the most direct cutting you can ever do. except for direct-to-disc, of course. But because Eddie Schreier and Gene Grimaldi can provide the best masters in the world, we're going to make the best vinyl in the world. And he already did it. It's just that we weren't physically in that location.
Right.
So this is an exciting time for vinyl. It really is. And I see every other market going crazy, but the vinyl is it's going through the roof.
Well, one thing I think might be interesting, if you would tell everybody how your systems have changed. Why are they better now than what people were using, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
Can we go back 150 years, 160 years?
Well, I know that just from an amplifier standpoint, the amps are so much different.
In the early days, I mean, we had maybe 7 or 8, 9 watts. I mean, when they first started cutting records, there was no power. Well, in the beginning, they were mechanical. They had nothing. The first amplifiers were maybe 10 or 12 watts. And then the 1940s and the 1950s, maybe had 50 watts was considered cool. By the 1960s, I think we had 100 watts.
You should explain what that means when you have 100 watts, and it's not what people are listening to. It's equivalent to how you're cutting, right?
Well, it gives you the 24-bit capability that we were talking
with
about
respect
earlier.
To the groove.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is we can cut things you can't play. I mean, if the groove geometry and the accelerations are too intense and too quick and just they're too violent, the stylus can't maintain intimacy. It's like you're driving your car down the road and the tires break traction. This is what happens when they can't track.
I got you.
So basically, when he masters,
right,
things track. And we can cut a groove that's going to play anywhere and it'll sound wonderful.
You know what? Really quick, that's amazing, the fact that you guys can – well, first of all, records – as a guy who like trained and learned on digital before I even got introduced to analog, it's amazing, you know, especially when I started talking to a lot of younger guys about, you move this little thing and it tracks this groove and it vibrates. And what you're listening to is the vibration. I mean, that just seems like voodoo, you know, that you can turn sound into something that you can hold.
It's a speaker to some degree.
You know?
Think about a speaker.
Yeah.
It's, transducer.
It's amazing. But the fact that you can control now using by the different wattage, how fine of an image that, because basically that's what, right? That's what it is basically the little grooves are like almost like a little image.
How does wattage
affect?
I think what he's wanting to say, it's all about headroom though. I think amplification, anybody that amplifies, for example, is aware of how much power low frequency takes. It's the exact same situation. Power supplies that suffer when low frequency is driven through them. Speakers will hit the stops and crack, and you hear distortion and DC synth. So the power requirement for cutting, well, if we get into the RIAA, I don't know if you want to go there, but the insertion curve, lacquers, there's a bit of technology here that I don't know if Dave wants to get into the depth. I'm going to let him do that. But the power is required basically for headroom. The more you can never have too much power. You can't have too big of a dam. And that includes if you're home speakers, you know, I always used to say, buy the amplifier that's the heaviest, simply because, even if it's less power, because I know it's got a bigger power supply.
Right.
And I suspect that the ability of that amplifier to handle low frequency peaks will be better.
So basically, you have all this new power to get you a higher quality master lacquer than with a better groove than we've ever had right now.
Again, the cutting technology, because of better cutter heads, and the better amplifiers.
Well, the way he's improved it.
And it is, well, you know, and it's funny though. Now, one of the lathes we use, you remember Mobile Fidelity? You remember them?
Sure.
Okay, we have that lathe that used and made all the historic recordings. They spent another $80,000 in just refining the mechanics and the electronics, about $100,000, and it was already a $330,000 lathe.
Wow.
And so it's so refined, and it's still, you know what? In the end, it's a damn piece of vinyl. But it's really refined. It's really refined.
So let me ask you a quick question. The actual cutting head for the lacquer master, what is that material? Is it diamond, or is it a blade? I mean, how fine of a tip is that you're cutting with?
Well, you know, they've discovered it's sapphire. Not diamond was a better cutting tool, because for some reason with a diamond – we couldn't get the groove to come off of the surface. It would just accumulate and roll up. And right now we suck it up into a tube and it stays in a jar that Eddie can burn later.
Sacrifice is coming up quick.
But it's interesting that Neumann, one of the last cutter heads they developed, they had newly available technology as far as alloys for the coils.
Right.
Because the coils could now take 100 degrees centigrade more temperature. The excursion capabilities was improved, and also they had they had about a 4 dB increase in sensitivity to the cutter head, and it didn't exist before. So increased temperature, excursion capabilities, and dynamic range was much, much better. It didn't exist. So it really paved the way for making use of digital technology. We can cut records you can't play. We can make use of 384 or whatever, but it's perfect, but I don't know if that's necessary.
No, we won't get into inner diameter roll off and all the rest of the
things. So anyway, but the fact is that we have technology on our side today.
All right.
Everything that we can do today, 30 years ago, we couldn't do.
All right.
So we're in a new place, and it's a new time for vinyl.
Now, when you say you cut masters that we can't play, are there any places that can play them?
Okay. What I mean is, unless you have a V15 Type 5 Shure cartridge that has that trackability capability, I used to test my records like that, and I thought, this is stupid. Nobody in the world can play these records. So I'll take an Ortofon. It's just the standard Ortofon, the nightclub playback stylus. If it sounds good there, I know it'll sound good anywhere because it'll track in any situation. I think the Stantons are a little bit harsh and a little brittle sometimes, but...
I think Restoration Hardware sells a turntable, for Pete's sake. I can't imagine the compliance on that cartridge being exactly
compliance is a big issue, but...
Compliance is the ability of the stylus sitting in the groove.
You need to maintain intimacy with that groove under any condition.
Bobby, let me ask you, describe, being the writer that you are, describe the vinyl sound for people.
You see cracking and
then you know. The first two or three times you play vinyl, it's transcendently analog. It's smooth sounding. It sounds warm. It sounds distinct yet not brittle.
I need a Corona.
Beyond that, it degrades.
When you're jogging or in your car, the records don't work so well?
Yeah, right.
Every play.
You start to get snaps and pops and stuff like that, although you might have it from the first one anyway, depending on the first play on how pure the vinyl was to begin with. But that being said, it degrades and the high end starts to go away.
I think it's 2,500 pounds a square inch, the stylus sitting there.
Now, another thing I want to mention.
Sounds like another sacrifice coming up.
For all the listeners out there that might be confused by some of this, it's all in my mastering book, the Mastering Engineer's Handbook.
Which is a great book.
There's a whole section on vinyl mastering in there, including a lot of pictures and a lot of pictures of grooves and what good grooves look like and bad grooves and stuff like
dog
that.
Dog legs.
Oh, that's perfect.
No, dog legs.
Man, there's just, you know, there's just so much into cutting a record. I mean, it's just amazing.
So what about cutting an A-track?
No, but there's something. I want to ask really
click,
quick.
Click.
There's something about listening to some of the great records from the 70s that
like Saga.
Earth, Wind and Fire, Steely Dan, all the ones that people go to as the references. But how are transients in vinyl? How does it handle the fast? Because snare drum and things like that, because I noticed the snare has a really great ballsy sound, but it doesn't kill you. You know what I mean?
Well, and it sounds more natural, but it's definitely dynamically impaired.
It's controlled.
And it's also separation is, dynamic range on a CD compared to vinyl is.
But think of it, you can hold up
65 dB.
Well, you get to hold up this beautiful gatefold and color. By the way, the psychology today, the adults and the kids love vinyl because it's intimate. They've got full-color pictures.
Right.
They can play this thing with a groove. They can touch it, hold it, and it's beautiful.
That's great, you'd say.
I mean, you can't do that with an MP3.
I remember the big compromise with CDs was the artwork. Where's the artwork going to go?
There were so many records were bought on sight, not sound.
Absolutely.
Where you'd go into the record store and you'd flip
King
through
Crimson.
And you'd go, oh, hey, this looks really cool, and you'd buy it because of the cover. That's gone now.
The jackets cost more than the vinyl. The vinyl is 30 cents. The jacket may have cost
the artwork and whatever respectively was
art.
Well, hey, listen, there's just so much. I'm overwhelmed.
I'm sitting at the right table.
David, thank you so much for coming over here and explaining some of these things, because it really, you know, a lot of people don't understand, including myself, as to how it was all done, and it was great, and I'm totally looking forward to checking out Oasis Mastering with your setup over there, because it sounds like you guys are going to be doing some really, really great things.
And read Bobby's book, by the way. That is, it's probably one of the most comprehensive on vinyl I've seen in modern times of anything out there. So
it is the Mastering Engineer's Handbook. Without a doubt.
Yeah, it's still, it's, do you have another printing of that again?
Yeah, it's a second edition. Yeah.
It's because he prints very slowly.
Well, people will understand the relationship of groove geometry to... But it's sonically speaking, they'll understand that.
And Eddie, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And you know what?
I hope I wasn't.
I gotta ask you a question that Scott started to ask at the very beginning of the segment. But when it comes to compression and multiband compression, and when you're doing your mix and things like that, bad, good, your best friend, your worst enemy?
No, compression is a very good
multiband. Multiband.
Specifically, the reason I mentioned multiband was for sound effects reasons. And also, in other words, music, it applies the same, but multiband compressors are terrific because you can focus in on respective frequencies that are a problem. Example might be a snare drum that's mixed possibly a little hot and a little too bright. At least you know you can calm it down without necessarily killing the guitars, which are living in the same spot, 3 to 5K, right? So you have the precision, what I mentioned. The precision multiband, I believe, is a 5-band.
Right.
I use it enough. I should remember. It's 5-band multiband. Anyway, you can select frequency ranges where you want this compressor to work. Very good tool. Overall compression would be Fairchild's or terrific. Again, I'm talking about my UAD plugs. Fairchild, the precision compressor is terrific, and I have an SSL compressor is terrific. But again, I think if we leave with anything else, compressors are your best friend if you drive them properly. If you overcompress, you're going to find that your instruments become dull and lifeless. You've gone too far. If you have to EQ it back with maybe. If I was to put a number on it, if you're EQing 30% hard now to get the overcompressed track back to life, you're doing too much compression. I find it better to use multiple compressors, having them work less hard several times than one big compressor pulling 5 or 6 dB. I'd rather have two compressors pulling 1.5 to 2 than one pulling 6.
I got you.
If you understand.
Yeah.
So you daisy chain, and specifically, that being said, daisy chain different compressors because they each have different sounds. I have certain, the UAD, I want to say the SSL compressor has a bit of a mid-range bump. So I kind of like that if a track has a little bit, I call a smile. If it's a little dull in the middle, I have a certain compressor that actually spikes the mid up a bit.
Huh.
It's wonderful. I don't have to EQ. I can just use a compressor for that now. I'd rather use a compressor to get sound. Same as a proper mic position than I would EQ.
So you're using it almost as threshold-based EQ.
That is correct. That's a good way to – absolutely correct. I'm using it – but it's a win-win. You get apparent level. You get control. You get peak dynamic control, which is huge because on the back end, the more controlled your tracks are as you blend them, the less they will fight each other. You know, well-produced – I think this was – a well-produced track can mix itself. We mentioned, you know, properly,
right.
David mentioned it, great equipment in the wrong hands is not going to be much help. But anyway, if you're properly listening and mixing and you're using compression properly, it can be your best friend to get apparent level, as I mentioned, and just control of these tracks so that even some of the lesser – you'll find as you mix a lesser – track that's not produced terribly well might not – if you're fighting a mix, it might be the arrangement. If you're not fighting the mix and the faders are just coming up and everybody's happy and all these multitude of instruments are coming up, mixing very easily, you have a very good arrangement. And then less is more.
Nice.
And with that, I think I've stepped enough. Less is always more.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say one last thing is that one thing I found is, though, with a lot of these sampler libraries, that everything is kind of mellow and sometimes, to me, lifeless. Like some of the strings and the percussion. It's there, but it doesn't what I call pop. It
doesn't have power.
It doesn't have the power. So a lot of times,
that's your
Mickey,
expanders.
Fable 3,
right.
Some of the stuff that I was mixing, I found those using Transmod, which is actually putting peaks back in to the stuff, because all of a sudden I got percussion hitting or drums, and it's like bum, 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 rather than bum, bum, bum.
Because they sound exciting again.
Yes, I wanted to give it a little more of that.
Life.
Yes.
Life and excitement.
A little more excitement, and get, put that back in, because everything...
That's awesome. What's it called? Transmod?
Sonox, Oxford. It's transient, modulated, Transmod.
Huh.
I heard an interesting thing the other night where what they did was they cut off the front end of a sound, and it was anything you can think of, the attack, initial attack, and would play the remainder back, and you couldn't tell.
Everything sounds the same.
Everything sounds the same. You couldn't tell what it was. And it was that initial attack that made a huge difference. So you put that on, and all of a sudden it went from sounding like an organ to a piano.
Yep.
Or it went to sounding like an organ to a banjo. Or,
you can do it to
whatever.
Every single instrument every in single an orchestra. You can, a trumpet will become a violin. It's amazing.
But my point is, that attack is so important that if you squash it too much, you're changing the timbral balance.
Sure,
sure.
That's by a huge amount.
Attack and release is a very integral part, and obviously threshold is how much you're hitting. But attack and release is very important.
Especially at low levels.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, volume levels,
so that means just, you know, compress, but do it judiciously, you know. Do it with an eye towards not killing your mix. Hey, last thing I got to ask you, and this is mainly for the listeners out there, and I promise this will be the last thing. And I'm not taking advantage of just because, you know.
You have to edit the heck out of me.
No, but seriously, younger mixers, when you get stuff from you know, people that are starting out and things like that, where are the troubled frequencies for them? Are we? Is it the mids that are...
Well, when you get older, you get that really round sound. That's great.
That's a roll up.
I mean, seriously, if you were going to say, if you were going to tell a mixer out there, just say, hey, listen, you know, watch your mids or watch your highs.
I know what the answer is going to be to this one.
Well, you know, I think of two things. One, I think my initial gut reaction is that if you're going to mix and you've done the tracks, I generally start with the low frequency first, low end for the basic track, if you will. So I'm going to start with the bass, the drums, the bass guitar, and the drum track to feel the kick drum hitting and the bass properly balanced. Now, generally the mids and highs will roll in comfortably if you have an ear, and they will feel balanced. If you start with the highs first, and you start – well, this applies with the bottom also. But if you start with the high-frequency instruments first, if you start too bright, if you're tired and you start too bright, you're going to then be distorted on the high end. The high end's too bright. And then what you do, if you want to balance, you're going to slam too much bottom in it. So now you're all wrong. It's generally easier, at least for me, to always start with the low frequency.
The rhythm.
The rhythm, and exactly. You'll feel – more comfortable, quicker, starting with the low frequency. That's, and again, that being said, if you don't have a subwoofer and you've got too much bottom poured onto the mix without knowing it, now you're going to make it too bright in the middle and the top. So the treble frequencies generally occur. They could be anywhere from the highs to the lows. But the most important part, I guess, is having to some degree, starting with an accurate listening environment. Doing some rough mixes, and God bless the car, because I'll tell you, you run out to the car with those rough mixes, because you can play your CDs one after another, that little 6x9, a little 4x5 speaker. If that's killing you, popping, snapping, you know you're in trouble. So then go back, and then, of course, always play CDs that you're happy with, you know, that you like the sound of.
Right.
But if you, again, they're mastered, so you're prior to that stage, but you can certainly turn down the mastered CD and raise your own mix to the gains, to at least get that Fletcher Munson thing matched up.
Right.
But at least you can then understand possibly where you're going to be going with your balance.
That's
I hope that helps.
That's awesome.
Do you find you attack 400 hertz at all in that range?
If it's needed. Well, you know, you
to give some air.
Attack is in cutting.
Yeah.
So you're talking about mid-bass. I call that mid-bass. 2 to 400 is mid-bass. And again, it all comes – in mastering for a final mix – if the mix sounds dark, there could be a few reasons for that. the key to finding the mid-bass, if there is indeed a problem, I always listen to the drums and the bass. And if those toms are banging hard and the bass is kind of blurting out, that's going to be a mid-bass problem. So as soon as I hear that, yes, I would back off the mid-bass before I started adding mids and highs. Mm-hmm. So the trick is to start, if there is indeed a problem in the mid-bass, cut first and then cut possibly back. Still augment EQ mids and highs. But it's always been an issue whereby it's your initial start and your gut reaction to that mix on where you're going to go. If there's too much bottom in the mix, but you're not hearing it that way that day, and you start adding mid and top to balance it, you're in trouble. It's distorted.
Balance the bottom.
You have to identify. I generally start on the low frequency. You identify a problem, if it is indeed there, and work from there. But if you start from the bottom, 9 times out of 10, you will end up correct with a decent application of balance.
Nice.
Starting from the low frequency.
Well, hey, listen, we're going way long. Rob, you have one more comment?
One other beginner mistake that a lot of engineers make, too, is if there's any chance your stuff's going to go to vinyl, or even if not, you should not have the kick or the bass stereo. Not have the kick and bass. A lot of people don't realize that. Well, if you're going to vinyl, that's a surefire way to make the needle jump out of the groove.
We'll blend that at 700 cycles. It doesn't matter.
But if, well, yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a very good point.
That's a beginner mistake.
You're talking about low frequency being omnidirectional. There's no need to pan low frequency.
Ever. Even if your stuff's not going to vinyl.
Where do you stop with the tech?
You know what? And on that note, that's a great place for us to stop. And thank you so much, Eddie, for all your knowledge and for everything.
Make me sound intelligent. Thank you so much.
You sound intelligent as it is. All right. Well, hey, listen, before we go, Rob, are you working on anything? We'll make this fast.
I'm working on a lot of things. I'm doing music for 2 commercial campaigns. I'm working with Stevie Wonder on another software project.
Nice.
Probably our 100th one together or something. I don't even know at this point. And he has his big Christmas House Full of Toys show this Saturday, but by the time this airs, it was already over. So you missed it, folks. But trust me, it was awesome. Getting ready to start another record early next year and a bunch more commercials.
Nice. Brandon.
Well, we got this week's been a lot of Pirates.
Nice.
Pirates 4 and and as well as Sucker Punch is back, so we're working a little more on that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Forrest, we'll catch up with you on the next one, but you're working on anything right now?
Yeah, let's catch up on the next one. Basically, I'm behind the piano a lot. I'm writing again. Found myself. And just got back from Europe with Angelique Kidjo, so that was really good.
Great.
Really good. Right.
And Eddie, what's your latest disc?
Latest, Akon's coming in. John Gass is coming in with a mix from a pretty good artist, I understand. Young girl.
Great.
And we're getting our lacquer together, our lacquer mastering setup.
And David, that's getting set up over at Oasis?
Yeah. And by the way, the reissue market is probably the biggest of everything. I mean, everything's ever been done. All the Blue Notes that we're redoing now.
Right.
And then anything else that's ever been to vinyl. And since there's only a handful of people cutting, we'll be cutting till the end of time. I mean, in the old days, there must have been 200 rooms cutting years ago.
Right.
But now we only have a handful. So it's a busy time.
So job security.
Job security, yeah.
Exactly.
Nice.
My wife wants to divorce me. I never come home. She thinks I have another wife. I do. It's the kind of
Scott, what about you? You working on anything?
Yeah, you know, I think last time we spoke, I said, I could take December and kind of chill out and all that. Not so much. I just got sucked into a vortex. I'm working on a project called Red Riding Hood.
Right. I've seen the trailer.
Yeah. And I don't know when that's going to end, but I'm in there and I'm creating the wolf.
You know, that's not a good sign. If you say you're seeing the trailers and he's saying I just got pulled into the project, that means it's probably kind of stressful.
Yeah, I'd say that there was a 10-day period I seriously, literally did not see daylight.
Wow. That's crazy. Bobby, that was funny. There were emails that went back and forth between Bobby O and Bobby.
Yeah, right. I'm finishing up, I've just finished up another book and finishing up the DVD for it, an expert witness on a big media case, and getting ready to start a record next year.
Nice.
So, great.
Yeah, busy time.
Awesome.
How about you, Mike?
I'm in the process of moving rooms. I moved into one room, and it sounded really, really bad.
We'll vouch for that.
And all these guys, yeah, nothing like bringing the panel into your room going, hey, look, guys. And the first thing they do is, oh, you have a problem over here at 500 and you have a problem over here. Of course, I asked for it, so.
Yeah.
But doing that, and we're going to have you back on, Eddie, and talk about studio construction because from what I understand, you're kind of a handyman with that and – God knows I could use all
smoke
the
smoke and mirrors is true. It works every time.
All the help.
Remind that man behind the curtain.
But anyhow, so we're moving. We moved the podcast to a new room. So that's what you guys are listening to. This is our second podcast, and just basically getting ready for the new year.
And what show is this? What are we up to?
This is show number 98.
Wow.
We are two away from the big 100.
I'm feeling really old.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen in January sometime. I don't know if we're going to hit the NAMM thing just because of everybody who's involved in the podcast. Most people are going to be having their own crazy schedule at NAMM, so we may do something else there, guys. But
we'll have to wait to find out.
Yeah, but show number 100.
We just do a bunch of guitars in the background going,
But anyway, I can still do that.
But hey, listen, if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. You can also check us out on our Facebook page. And we appreciate
thank you for the comments. They were very cool.
Oh, yeah. We appreciate all the positive comments that are
and I'm
about
a day over 100.
Yeah, apparently Scott sounds like a toddler.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, right.
Scott, who's 21.
Yeah, no. That's what my wife says.
But you can reach us there, and you can look at some of the discussions, and we have a place for you if you have any comments as far as discussions or topics that you want us to cover. Put them in the discussion forum under topics, and we'll get to them sooner or later. But other than that, that's about it. So this is show number 98. I'm trying to stall to see if I hit everything that I needed to. And I did. All right. Well, thank you once
again,
Eddie.
Thank you so much.
You, David and Forrest, it's good to see you. And Rob, you're always here. And Brandon, next time we'll talk more. And Scott, you've got a new friend. And Bobby, looking forward to your new book. So for myself and from all the guys, have a happy holiday season. Have a happy new year. And we will see you next year.
On the other side.
Wow. 2011.
Thank you.
All right.
Take care. See ya.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.